Our guest today is Tom Wickenden. Tom is in the process of completing his PhD dissertation at the University of Pennsylvania. He has a BA in, of all things, English literature from Princeton, and a candidate in philosophy degree from UCLA, also in English literature, and MA in communications from the University of Pennsylvania, where he's now completing his PhD. His particular research interest is in the application of information theory to social systems, and in particular the analysis of information processing through economic, political, and cultural choice mechanisms. He has a recent publication, or a publication about to come out, on informational requirements of social choice mechanisms. Copies available. And his subject for today will be applications of information theory to human communication.
Whatever suits you.
Yes. I'm afraid you'll have to bear with me a little bit today. I'm still recovering from a bit of flu. I have a little bit of a cough, so you'll excuse that. I thought I would take about 30 minutes, more or less, and try and give you some idea of the general approach that I like to take to communications research, and maybe about 30 minutes or so on the specific applications that I've been working on. My presentation will have to do with information theory, or in general, mathematical theory of communication. But I'm not going to get into any of the technical details of it, and I'm not going to assume any particular knowledge on your part of information theory or any of the related theory. What I'm going to stress is the interpretation of the theory, or one or two or several ways in which one can interpret information theory, on one hand, and the implications of these interpretations on the other. You probably know that in 1948, Claude Shannon at Bell Labs in New Jersey published a couple of papers on what he called the mathematical theory of communication. Actually, this is a misnomer for two reasons. One is that the work of Shannon is actually only part of what you might call the mathematical theory, or it's only one of numerous mathematical theories of communication. There are about a half dozen different formal definitions of information available. There are numerous generalizations of Shannon's definition, which he called entropy. There are also several concepts in the statistical literature which are very closely related to information, all of which could be considered within this general bag of mathematical theories. Also, strictly speaking, Shannon's information theory is actually an abstract calculus. It's very useful for describing or calculating mathematical quantities, but in and of itself, it does not constitute a theory. It could only be described as a theory of communication, or more generally of information, when coupled with an interpretation, a set of rules spelling out correspondences between mathematical quantities in the mathematical system and entities and relations and properties of a real-world system. Nevertheless, Shannon's information theory is the best known and the most fully developed of mathematical theories, and it has a number of very useful properties which make possible applications to human communication research at all levels. Applications which I find are not generally known, and so I thought what I would do today is start out by describing some of these properties of information theory and by illustrating some of the applications of the theory. I'm going to talk about or mention five properties, the first of which is that it's a formal theory. Now, a lot of people feel that by being formal it's somehow a narrow, specialized theory, but in fact what it means to say that a theory is formal actually is just saying that it is not tied to any specific content. It just describes forms or formal relations. This means that it's a very general theory in terms of its applicability. For example, it was initially developed by Claude Shannon, who was a communications engineer. And in fact, most of the development up till now has been by engineers. On the other hand, it's been developed by psychologists. There's an aspect that I'm going to get into, multivariate information theory, which has been developed by biologists, psychologists, and social scientists. So it is not just an engineering theory by any means. Another aspect of its generality is that initially it was created to describe relations between signs or symbols, in particular symbols as they occurred at one end of a phone line and symbols as they occurred at another end. But it's subsequently been applied to describing relations between symbols and their denotations, to the semantic aspects of a message system, and also to the pragmatic aspects of a message system, relations between symbols and signs, their denotations, and also their practical effects on behavior in general. The second property, I think, that is an important one to point out is that communication information theory is a behavioral theory. By this I mean it can be used to analyze data which have been generated through an observation of behaviors. And it can be used to inductively derive descriptions and predictions of behavior in a communication system. Furthermore, an interesting aspect of information theory is that these data do not have to have either a metric or an order. Now, a lot of all parametric methodologies require that your data usually have at least an order. In other words, it has to be at least ordinal data, if not interval data. But it turns out that a lot of the kind of data we get in analyzing social systems is not that strong, does not have those kind of properties. And information theory is a tool that can be used on strictly nominal data, just classificatory data. You classify different states or values of a variable. They don't have to have any particular order or interval relation or ratio scale to them. So that makes for a very general theory. Another property of information theory is that it's a logical theory, by which I mean it has a quite well-developed logical component to it. This means that it can be used to make deductions from starting out from a set of assumptions, that it can be used heuristically to synthesize concepts, models, hypotheses, in situations, for example, where data are unobtainable for some reason, or prior to going into a situation and generating data. It can be used to give you as a guide to determining what kind of data would be most relevant to your particular problem. A fourth property of information theory is that it's a systems theory. One of the quantities that information theory is useful in describing is known as transmission of information. Well, transmission is basically a description of the extent to which two or more entities are related. And so by definition, if you define a system as a set of entities or components and the relations between those, information theory is a systems-oriented theory. Furthermore, information theory is generalizable to describing relations between any number of components and relations of any order, which is a particular development that I'm going to talk about in a few minutes. The fifth property of information theory that I want to mention is that it's what I would call a relative theory, by which I mean that if it's used to describe a system, that the system is always described in terms of an observer. Information theory can never be used to make an absolute, an objective, or a value-free statement. It always has to be tied to the particular observer who has coded the data on which the information descriptions are from which they are inductively derived. Now, rather than go through a general catalog of applications of information theory, I thought what I would do is focus on some recent developments with respect to these last two properties of the theory, that it's a systems-oriented theory, that it's a relative theory, or observer relative theory, and discuss the implications of these developments for the study of human communication. I want to sort of dramatize this a little bit, and I may be over-dramatizing it, but if you'll bear with me, I think it's kind of fun to look at it this way. One can describe the development of a theory in terms of different stages. Theories very often start out simply by making obvious statements in slightly more formal terms, by examining the most simplest cases of the phenomenon. The next stage might be, the theory might be developed to the point where you can clarify previously intuitive and non-systematic understandings of a more complex phenomenon. And then finally, a theory might be developed to a stage where it can solve previously unsolvable problems, predict the unknown, explain the previously inexplicable. Examples of this third stage are common in fields like astronomy, where, for example, years ago they were able to predict the existence of another planet, I think it was Pluto, by looking at the perturbations of Venus and some of the other planets, before anyone had actually observed Pluto out there. A more current example are the concept of black hole in astronomy. Another field where this occurs quite regularly is atomic physics, where they're discussing quarks and antimatter and numerous subatomic particles which people don't have direct evidence of yet. Now, 10 years ago, Ross Ashby completed the development of an aspect of information theory which allowed him, in effect, to predict the existence of a type of communication which is largely counterintuitive, and which even today is only indirectly perceived, or in generally, it's ignored completely. The development that he worked on can be described as multivariate information theory. And the description of the type of communication which the interpretation I'm giving to this, the name I give to it, is collective communication. And I think it deserves it's useful to give it a label somewhat different from just communication, to point out the distinctions between maybe the more classic models of communication and this collective concept of communication. I like to describe it in two terms.
Tell me, Professor Logan. Could you explain more what you mean? He predicted a type of information that was counterintuitive. I don't understand what you mean.
Well, this is just what I'm going into. What he did was he developed multivariate information theory.
Yeah, okay. That's a label.
Right.
You call it collective communication.
But that's the interpretation I'm giving to.
Okay.
What
I'm trying to figure out is what you mean by he predicted it. I mean, whether he discovered it or whether it's something that we've known about for centuries and he just put a label on it.
Well, I have a feeling it's something that some people, many people perhaps, do know about. But it's something that in the texts on communication, you rarely find spelled out specifically. You rarely find a precise model of it.
Yeah, but that's true. Any text on communication, I don't know anything about communication, we take that as a sort of base, right? Anything we get in the mail for communication.
Well,
right?
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, if we start on the assumption that, yes, everyone really knows about this, then I'll rephrase what I'm saying. Say that what he did was developed this formal calculus to the point where it could describe with a degree of precision far greater than had previously been available this type of multivariate interaction, which, as we're under the assumption that you've given me, there are many people who do know about this.
But
it makes it more dramatic, though, to say nobody knows about it. So, and in fact, there are a lot of people who write these textbooks
It's a history, really.
Right, the distinction between the kind of communication models you often see in texts and the kind that you can derive from this multivariate information theory, I like to describe it in terms of two distinctions. One is the classic concepts of communication very often have to do with bivariate relations, have to do with relations between a source and a receiver, for example. whereas collective communication describes multivariate relations, relations between a number of sources simultaneously and a number of receivers. And the second distinction I like to use is between dyadic transactions, where you have a message or some sort of a structure, information at one point in space and time, and it's transmitted or transported across space and through time over to another point. And collective communication can't be described this way in general. In general, it has to be described as a polyadic interaction. In other words, first of all, you're no longer dealing with dyads with two points. You're dealing with many points. And secondly, you're no longer dealing with this sort of a linear transmission. You're dealing with circular interactions within systems. Now, I want to give you a little more concrete idea of what I'm talking about. So I'll use the blackboard here. All right, what do I mean when I'm talking about relations? Well, let me just list a few. So let's start out with just a description of a set of components. Let's call them people. And we just label them A, B, C, D, etc. Now, in what ways can these people be related? First of all, we can show that A and B can be related. And A and C can relate to each other, and B and C, and A and D, etc. Now, we can also pair them in triads. So we can have A, B, C, and A, B, D, etc. And we can pair them in quartets, or whatever. We get A, B, C, D, etc. Now, if we describe these relations in terms of the order of relation, what we're saying here is we have a first order, or unary, or univariate relation, and here we have a second order, or binary, or bivariate relation. Here we have something very different. We get up into third order, tertiary relations, and for everything above second order, I'll be calling higher order. Or multivariate. Well, everything above first order is multivariate.
Which is the primary
relational
level?
Excuse me?
Which is the primary level?
Well, technically, in terms of information theory, you can actually get down here to, not information theory, mathematics, you can get down here to a zero order, but that's just confusing the issue. So I'm going to start here with this primary order where if you wanted to describe this in terms of communication, what you're talking about here is intrapersonal. It's not usually what we look at in social systems where you're looking interpersonal. Everything above here is interpersonal. Now, usually when we study communications in systems or wherever, the classic kind of analysis has to do with these binary dyadic relations. But I just call this classic to distinguish it from collective communication, which takes into account all multivariate relations. So this is what I mean by collective. It includes this binary, but it also tertiary and higher order relations. Now, just to give you an idea of how you would describe this in information theory, you'd start out here with binary relations. In terms of a transmission, T just means transmission, or we can interpret it as communication. I don't know if you can see this over there, but so T. And this is binary transmission, so you have a transmission between, let's say, X and Y. It could be A, B, A, C, any two of these entities or people in this case. Now, when you get up to this level of third order, this is so different from this classic concept of a source X talking to a receiver Y, that Ashby gave us a different symbol. It's very essential to distinguish this, so he gave it the symbol Q, and he called it interaction. So this is T is transmission, Q is interaction,
At this level, you've got X, Y, and Z. And here you've got Q, X, or W, X, Y, Z, etc. All the way up. All of these are Qs. All of them are interactions. They're all higher order relations. This transmission down here is a binary transmission. And this is what I'm suggesting is often usually found in studies, communication studies. Now, I don't want to deal with any formulas here. I didn't want to put any on, but I thought maybe I would just put up one because it makes so clear the distinction between these kinds. Now, let's just deal with this system of three people here, A, B, and C. We can define the transmission or the communication. This is the total amount of communication in this system. T, A, B, C. This is equal to the sum of all these dyadic relations, all the binary communications. So we'll go T, A, B plus T, A, C plus T, B, C. Plus our interaction term right up here. Now what does this mean? Well, the implication is that you can have an amount of communication in this system. Let's call it 4 bits. Doesn't matter. Any amount. At the same time, you can have no communication between pairs. 0 plus 0 plus 0. And you can have all of it at this higher order, plus 4 bits.
Tom, what if B is black and lower class?
I get
not
that.
Not white, middle class.
This is a description. I mean, one way of interpreting this is a description of observations you've made. So you might want to say, for example, B never relates to A and C together. Well, if that's the case, then this is not describing the system you're referring to. All I'm saying is this description is possible. It is possible to have a system in which A and B are not relating, A and C are not relating, and A and B and C do not relate.
As long as everybody's equal. They have to be equal, or the formula is nonsense.
At this point I'm not going to interpret this. I mean, leave that for a few minutes.
An interpretation, some kind, if it refers to some kind of reality, then every single communicator, sender, receiver, in that formula must be equal in economic status, psychological status, and every other way. They must be equally rational or the whole thing just is nonsense.
Well, no.
It doesn't.
For the thought, let me give you an example.
Okay.
Let's say you have two jailers and a prisoner. All right? Now, it may be that the two jailers, who are A and B, talk to each other, relate to each other, but they may not. Maybe they're enemies. Maybe they...
You mean that doesn't they don't relate?
Maybe. It's possible, but they don't relate.
Enemies is a way of relating, right?
Excuse me?
Enemies is a way of relating.
That's true. I have to think of a better... Maybe they come on at different shifts.
All right?
So they don't really even know about the other's existence. All right? And maybe... this would be a little hard, too. So, yeah, I have a lot of interpretations of these higher order relations.
Put the question in parentheses and go on.
All right.
Let me
just say, for example, this could be a situation in which the state or the relation or the value of the prisoner is dependent on or determined by not just A and not just B, but on a relation between A and B. So here's an example. Let's say that if A and B are having a good day, or if A and B meet each other or something like that, somehow they relate, then and only then does C get a good meal, let's say, or does C get to exercise that day. If that's a situation in which A and B and conversely, only when C gets to exercise can you predict that A and B are actually sitting in the office drinking beer. Then all the relation between the three of them would only occur would only be described by this term, and you wouldn't have any of these. But what I'm going to try and get at is, what does this mean? And I have some examples on a variety of levels that I'll get to that might help clarify this. Let me just throw up a couple of models, though. First, back in 1948, Shannon and Weaver proposed this kind of a model with a source and a receiver, and maybe you throw a transmitter in there or whatever, but basically you've got this binary thing with a channel here. Now, when you're talking about multivariate or polyadic situations, obviously you've got to expand this or generalize on it. So what do you have? Well, one way of looking at it might be to put a whole number of sources here, connect them all through the channel to a whole number of receivers. Now, it turns out, though, that there are situations where this kind of a transmission across here from one group to another group, it turns out in some situations this group is identical with this group. Think of voting, for example. In a voting situation, let's say you have a committee and they're voting on, they're voting their salaries, or they're voting on work assignments, or they're voting on what will we do to solve this problem? What position will we take? All right, well, they all vote. Well, that's a transmission of information through this channel, which is, in this case, a decision rule, majority rule, or something like that. And where does the message, what message comes out here? Well, the message is, we'll increase our salaries by $1,000. Well, the receivers are these same people here that voted. So you can't have this kind of model. And one I just throw up here was presented by my advisor, Klaus Gryffindor, in a paper in 1970. Basically, what he did is he put these people down here in a line with these, and he took the channel and put it up here. So what, in terms of a model, what you've got is like a channel here, components down here, and you have a possibility for all these relations through the channel, not only with themselves, like memory or whatever, but this component relating to this one, relating to this one relating to all of these, this to all. So you have a model where you have a system of people here, and they can all relate on all orders. They can vote, they can talk, whatever. I'm suggesting that this is a way of beginning to look at what do we mean by higher order relations. Now, the question I'd like to raise is, does this collective communication exist? If it does, what does it look like? It turns out that in terms of the scenario I'm presenting, it's counterintuitive. If you think, for example, about speech, what happens when two people talk at the same time? Well, what you get is interference. You don't get some sort of higher order relation. You don't get anything different. You get nothing. You can't understand them because they're talking at the same time. So it turns out that speech is usually one of these binary, dyadic kind of models. You can't have four people talking at the same time, or even talking to themselves at the same time. It doesn't work like that. Excuse me?
I said it works very well in our department.
Another thing, it turns out that this kind of communication is what I call collective. Resists representation. It's very difficult to represent it. A lot of times in communication studies, we use matrices and graphs. Turns out collective communication can't be described with two-dimensional models, like matrices and graphs. You have a matrix. Let's put our A, B, C people in here, and you ask them questions. Who do you talk to? Well, A talks to B and C, B talks to A and C, C talks to A and B. Well, where's A, B, C? It's not in there. You can't really get it. Let's just use point nodes, in lines. Here's B, here's C. A talks to C, A talks to B, B talks to C. How do you get A, B, C in there? You can't do it. Maybe it doesn't exist. What is it? Well, I hope to convince you that not only does it exist, but that there are significant applications for this concept on all levels of human communications research. Let me start, for example, with interpersonal, face-to-face communication. I want to give you a quote from Colin Terry's book on human communication. 20 years ago,
Cherry wrote this: "The human senses do not possess one set of constant properties to be measured independently, one at a time. It is even questionable whether the various senses," in quotes, "are to be regarded as separate, independent detectors. The human organism is one integrated whole, stimulated into response by physical signals. It's not to be thought of as a box carrying various independent pairs of input terminals labeled ears, eyes, nose, etc." Now, in the last 20 years, there's been a lot of research on nonverbal modes of communication. And there's been some research on the interrelation between modes. But as far as I can tell, there hasn't been any progress made on analyzing the structure of these interrelations between modes. No progress, that is, beyond providing some empirical support for Cherry's suggestion that these are not independent. For example, I'll cite Ray Birdwistle, who's the resident kinesiologist at the Annenberg School. Professor Birdwistle puts a lot of emphasis on communication being a multi-channel process. For example, he writes, "Not only is speech behavior organized and codified, but so also is the information carried over a still indeterminate number of other channels. Furthermore, not only is spoken language not treated as the communicative system employed by man, but it is regarded as infra-communicational. That is, language does not stand alone, but is interdependently meshed with structured infra-communicational behavior from other channels in the communicative situation. Now, if single channels are infra-communicative, that is, if they can't even be analyzed separately in terms of the information transmitted through them, what we need to do, obviously, is to study them collectively. But the linguistic approach that's usually taken toward this kind of nonverbal communication appears to be incapable of describing these higher-order relations between modes." I don't find it surprising, therefore, that Birdwistle concludes by saying, "Since regularities appear in the stream of movement and in the stream of audible behavior around certain syntactic forms, it's possible to state that body motion and spoken languages do not constitute independent systems at the level of communication. By a logic not yet known," now this is 1971, that's what, 15, 16 years after Cherry said the same thing, "he still doesn't know what the logic is. By a logic not yet known, they're inter-influencing and probably interdependent." Now, the implications of what I'm saying are three. The first is that the linguistic approach is probably incapable of analyzing the collective nature of human interaction. Secondly, even in a dyadic situation, communication is not bivariate, nor is it a linear transaction. For example, I'm speaking to you, and presumably you're hearing something of what I'm saying. Simultaneously with that, I'm gesturing and moving around, non-verbally communicating, and presumably you're seeing some of that. Now, if I wanted to describe the relation between myself as a source and the message that you're receiving, I'd have to describe that at least as a tertiary relation. Secondly, at the same time that I'm talking to you, I'm looking at your movement. So in a sense, I'm seeing how you react to what I'm saying, and it's almost simultaneously that you're communicating to me and I'm communicating to you. So it'd be very difficult to describe this interaction in terms of these linear transactions. You really have to use this interactive concept. What time did I start? I've got a lot of time.
Take whatever you need. We'll stop you if you go too long.
All right, I'll go for another 15 minutes on these examples, all right? And then I'll get to my own stuff, if you can hold on that long. I want to go through a couple more of these. Let's think about verbal interaction for them. If the focus of analysis is put on the information transmitted through spoken, written symbols, rather than on the physical symbols themselves, you can see that collective communication can be established even through a spoken interaction. Consider the process of personal influence described, for example, by Katz and Lazarsfeld in their 1955 study of personal influence. In particular, think about the concept of the two-step flow, you know, like from the media down to the opinion leaders, from opinion leaders to the opinion seekers or followers, all of whom are, you know, members of some sort of a primary group. Let's ask ourselves, what kind of information can an opinion leader transmit? to opinion seeker in this group? Well, first of all, he can tell him what his opinion is of whatever issue is raised. Secondly, he can tell this seeker what the opinions of the other group members are. Thirdly, he can tell this opinion seeker whether he, the leader, will inform the other members of the group as to what the opinion seeker's opinion is of this on this issue. And fourthly, he could tell him, of course, most of this is implicit, but he could also tell the seeker what the reaction of the members of the group is going to be to the opinion expressed by the opinion seeker. Now, if you add to this the opinion seeker's knowledge of his own reaction to what the reactions of the group members are going to be to hearing about what his opinion is, then you have the boundary conditions for a very complex, circular, multivariate flow of information, resulting in communication behavior on the part of the opinion seeker, which cannot be fully represented as an asymmetrical flow of influence from the leader to the seeker.
Before you go on to the other example, this might be rude, you can refuse the request. I'm going to have to leave before, if you're going to spend 15 more minutes on examples and get your own stuff. I'd really like to hear your own stuff.
Okay. I'll tell you what. Anyone who's interested in the other examples I have, if you can ask me, I'll either come back to them or you can ask me about them in the question and answer session. I'll just tell you what they are. I can show you in particular how it can be applied to organizational communication. It's very, very important there because the essence of organizational communication, the most important aspects of communication in an organization has to do with relations between behavior, not so much what my telling you, you know, the hierarchy, messages of what this guy should do or what that guy should do, but how they're related. And it's this multivariate interaction that can describe these relations. I can show you how I might apply it to mass communication. And I can show you how to apply it to institutional aspects of communication, for example, in economic systems, political systems, legal systems, sociocultural systems. Now, in my own research, I focus on collective communication in economic and political institutions. The reasons that I focus on these institutions are several. First of all, it seems to me that communication through economic and political systems has received relatively little attention in the communications literature. Secondly, these kind of systems are relatively well-defined, and therefore they're among the easiest collective communication channels to analyze with this newly developing theory. Thirdly, there are numerous salient real-world problems related to collective communication at the institutional level. And fourthly, there's an established body of theoretical and empirical research on these problems, which you can relate the developments of the theory to. Now, the area that I'm dealing with most is generally called social choice, or more precisely, collective social choice, or simply collective choice. Now, I've chosen to focus on two specific problems. One I call provision of public goods, and the other I call the determination of social welfare. The problem inherent in the provision of public goods was most clearly expressed by Manper Olson in his book on the logic of collective action. And the problem is this. He writes, unless the number of individuals in a group is quite small, or unless there is coercion or some other special device to make individuals act in their common interest, unless all these things, rational, self-interested individuals will not act to achieve their common or group interest. He goes on to say, the achievement of any common good or the satisfaction of any common interest means that a public or collective good has been defined for that group. And then he defines a common, collective, or public good as any good such that if any person in a group consumes it, it cannot feasibly be withheld from the others in that group. The best illustration of this problem, one of the best, is Garrett Hardin's exposition of what he calls the tragedy of the commons. It has to do with a group of farmers raising cattle on a commons. And he shows that...
Oh, that's the biggest piece of anthropological bullshit that ever came out of anything.
Well, it's totally hypothetical.
That is just crap.
Let me give you a better example.
I'm not kidding.
Throw that one out.
No, you can't.
Let me give you an example from communications of the tragedy of the commons, all right? And then you can tell me whether it's bullshit. The example has to do with the use of the radio frequency spectrum in the United States between the Radio Acts of 1912 and 1927. In the early 20s, there was a proliferation of radio stations in the United States. And they began interfering with one another. And the Secretary of Commerce, Herbert Hoover, called a series of national radio conferences to try and work out the situation. And he described these conferences as experiments in industrial self-government. Turns out these conferences were, as the logic of collective action would predict, utter and complete failures. The industry was totally unable to organize itself and to coordinate their behavior in a way that would allow for an efficient allocation of the radio frequency resource. Only an act of Congress in 1927 was able to assert and enforce the common interest in an efficient allocation over the individual interest or individual right of any station to broadcast.